What does a married man or woman have to do to take robes? Who does he have to ask for permission? The teacher, his wife, his parents? Can he go into robes owing debts? So for a married person, then they have to have the permission of their spouse. That's the immediate responsibility. And of course, they have to have permission of the teacher, otherwise it doesn't get out of the starting blocks. But there needs to be somebody willing to take he or she on as a trainee. And debts, yeah, one has to have resolved one's debts before taking robes. There's, in the ordination, there's certain qualifying questions, and one of them is around debts, one of them is around, yeah, having permission, having the requisites of robes and bowl all prepared, having being free from certain illnesses that would end up being a burden or problematic, free from government service. It's about all that's coming to mind right now. But those are questions that are asked in the ordination. And ideally, of course, one has dealt with all those questions before the ordination, and then at the time of the ordination, then it's sort of just part of the ceremony. You referred to the Visuddhimagga by Buddhaghosa a few times this week. Is this the principal source of suttas and discourses? Would it be valuable for laypersons to study, assuming it has been translated into English? The Visuddhimagga is a practice text compiled about 1,000 years after the Buddha passed away, so that really the principal source of suttas and discourses are the discourses themselves, and that's there's compilations that have been passed on since the of course the early days of the Buddha's teaching. They were recited orally, and then about 350-400 years after the Buddha passed away, then they were written down in Sri Lanka. And then the Visuddhimagga is an overview, kind of manual of Buddha's teachings and practice. It would be valuable for lay people to study. It has been translated into English. It was translated in the early or mid 1950s. It's not the most scintillating. So that, it's different people respond to it in different ways. And, I mean, I particularly find it boring. But I might not be the best example to follow. Certainly in traditional Buddhist cultures, and it's a highly regarded text. And one of the things that I referred to as coming from the Visuddhimagga today, speaking about the three different kinds of wisdom, is actually, and thank you Guy for the note, it's in from Sutta number 33 in the Digha Nikaya, this classification of those three different types of wisdom, the wisdom arising through hearing and the wisdom arising through reflection, thought, and wisdom arising through practice. I enjoy reading suttas, but rarely remember them well. Any suggestions for recalling all these wonderful itemized lists? Yeah, if anybody has any suggestions, I'd be interested. it's just sort of plugging away and, you know, reading them and hearing them over and over again that you know, it finally clicks or finally is able to retain. And it's always a bit frustrating. You remember a particular sutta and tell about the five of this, and then you come up with four. And it's all right. Paul Gerhardt.
Yeah.
Map of the Dhamma. That's a really good way of recalling them. I'm relying more and more on my iPhone these days. Access the Insight app and the collections of all the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations on my iPhone. So. I don't know if the venerable elders at the time of the that was, you know, even when the suttas were written down, that was kind of seen as like Buddhism had really hit the degenerate age by then. Just that people couldn't remember them anymore and had to go and write them down. It was just really beyond pathetic. I don't know what they say about iPhone apps. With age, contentment and gratitude, and even joy, come swiftly and easily to my meditation. I have good reasons for them, too. They can also seem like roadblocks to mindfulness, slowing my mind, which is still proliferating, not investigating. What should I do when I feel this? You have already answered this in your talks, but I would like to be told again. Again, it's sort of using it, one's paying attention to balance and a sense of balance, clarity, so that those qualities of joy and contentment, gratitude, bring a sense of brightness and a well-being to the mind, which helps the mind to settle. But it's also in the nature of joy and that kind of lightness of mind that it can sometimes be associating with good things, and then it moves and isn't as settled, so that there's that attending to a sense of well-being, and I think clarity is probably the main quality to be attending to, because sometimes one needs to bring to mind things that help to either to sometimes have a sobering effect or a grounding effect. There's another list that are called the four protective meditations. So that these are four particular types of meditation that are considered both protecting and guarding and nurturing one's practice. And one is recollection of the Buddha, and the other is loving kindness. But then there's also the recollection of the unattractive aspects of the body, and then recollection of death, so marana-sati. So these are kind of protective meditations, because one can be using them at the appropriate time for allowing the mind to become settled, stable, still, and clear. And sometimes what is needed is the uplifting brightening side of things, and at other times it's more the sobering and the energizing aspect of directing attention, so that we we need to be rather than coming from some boilerplate formula of what we think we should do, or what we've conceived of through some ideal, we have to actually pay attention to what does the mind need, what is going to be useful, what's going to be beneficial, and work from that. I notice that in retreats of this length, there is a certain trajectory of depth of concentration. During the final 1 or 2 days, the mind is a bit busier, more slippery. This is not because of being disengaged in the process. It is just what is, quote, in brackets, for me. So my question is around whether it is skillful use of this remaining time to turn to contemplations of well-being as a way to aim calm and soothe, or better to try to simply watch the process of the mind emerging from the depth of retreat. My nature is such that all of the wishing well for self and other that I can muster is always needed. Now again, I think it builds on the previous question of attending to what is going to be beneficial, because sometimes we need to rely on the like those contemplations of well-being as a means of as a samatha, settling, calming, soothing quality, and particularly if there's if there's some agitation or excitement, anxiety around that, just the expectation of the retreat ending, but also this is where one can only learn this through experimenting, in that using the contemplation and investigation to start to look more clearly at what is that process of what is it that hooks the mind, what is it that is so interesting. And you think of, especially for those who've done retreats, multiple retreats over time, when seeing a pattern, and in reality, it's sort of the same. We fall for the same old hook every time. So that really being able to contemplate and understand what, and this is really important because we really start to see what are those underlying tendencies? What are the underlying habits of mind that do keep us going to more becoming, to more movement of mind, more papancha, the delighting in proliferation. So that turning the mind to the investigative side of things, especially when at toward the end of the retreat, things are getting pretty basic. Even if the mind is moving out, it's still pretty basic, pretty fundamental. So that one can really get an insight into the nature of the mind. To whom did you attribute the different formulation of the Four Noble Truths, going outside the mind knowing the mind? Many thanks for this, and much more. The monk's name is Ajahn Dun, say maybe like D-U-N-E, D-O-O-N. He was one of the early disciples of Ajahn Mun. Lived with him, trained with him in the quite early days, and then he went back to live in his home village, which was just on the edge of a very small, sleepy, quiet town in the northeast of Thailand called Surin, which he lived in the same monastery. I didn't really go anywhere for, it was over 50 years. Thailand's population exploded, and it turned into like a provincial center. And then the exhibition grounds, where this big elephant festival takes place every year, is right by the monastery. And so it's turned into his forest monastery, sort of outside of town. Just the town sort of crept around and enveloped him. And people used to complain. So I can't practice here. And so it's so, and there's so much noise and so many distractions. And Lumpur Dun was extremely blunt in his. So he just said, why do you let your mind go out there? There's nothing that's worth the mind going out to that. And for him, obviously, it wasn't a problem. But I think the conditions were challenging, but he was. I met him on several occasions and had some lovely discussions with him. He's very, very, very quiet. There's There's actually in Access to Insight, there is a translation of his teachings, and most of it is just sort of vignettes of conversations, because he really didn't do a whole lot of formal teachings, but he was an incredible example, and really exceptional practitioner. In the sutta, this is the Satipatthana Sutta, there is a reference to contemplating the body internally, contemplating the body externally, and both internally and externally. How is one supposed to use this in practice? So that one can be I mean, there's many different ways to do it, but just as your kind of bog standard approach is just, when we say internally, it's really contemplating one's own experience of the body, that sense of say just the basic hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, 32 parts of the body. That is a classic body contemplation, or contemplating the experience of the body as elements, the four elements of solidity, of fluidity, of heat, and of expansion, so that there's the earth, water, fire, air, so that contemplating the experience of that as one's own body, and then externally contemplating that basically every other body on the planet is exactly the same, and then both is just both. I mean, that's a standard way of approaching that, and that's a good foundation to establish oneself in when one's using that experience of the body. I've greatly appreciated the teachings on non-proliferation, especially Ajahn Khrunadamo's answer to last night's question regarding the underlying feeling that is often present and driving a particular proliferation. I live with an autoimmune disease which currently requires frequent adjustments to my medications. While lab work is helpful, my cluster of symptoms is a more precise indication of the need to go up or down in one or the other of my meds. I often feel a lot of anxiety or aversion when symptoms are more present, or when I'm ill with infections to which my body is quite vulnerable. I also feel pressure to track my symptoms, to quote-unquote figure it out, so my doctor can adjust my medication and I can feel better. It is quite a conundrum to try to care for this body, track the various symptoms, all of which I find unpleasant, and yet not to proliferate on what needs to happen next. Going to the body in my practice, while useful, is not reliably calming and sometimes seems to add fuel to the fire. This retreat I have been practicing with right view and right understanding by repeating key phrases from the daily talks, and have experienced the sinking in of what feels like a very deep insight at times. Do you have any words of guidance for when I go off retreat on working with this human body and with this all too human mind? Well, contemplation of dukkha sounds pretty easily to hand as a tool. So that contemplation of how dukkha is established, and then how we making a separation or an investigation in the difference between, say, like bodily dukkha and then mental dukkha, which we add to it, which is what the Buddha talked about in terms of, he used it in terms of vedana, in that the two different arrows, sort of like it's ordinary to get, like when sort of shot with the first arrow, to feel a certain discomfort and pain, but then sort of like the being shot with another arrow on top of that, and that's the sort of the kind of the mental or emotional pain that we add to the physical discomfort. Ajahn Chah uses the image of, he said it's like similar to when we go to the doctors and get an injection, and so that, yeah, there's that discomfort or pain when that injection comes in, when it pierces the skin. He said that is normal. That's ordinary. He said, but the mental or emotional pain is as if the needle is injecting poison into us, and then the pain that comes after is what we add through the proliferations that are put on top of that, so that to be able to come to a place of investigating and the difference between that, because we can experience certain levels of physical dis-ease, but and the mind can deal with it quite comfortably or skillfully until we start to get worried, to get anxious, to try too hard to define it, so that to be attending to trying to keep it as simple as possible, and then the relaxing around even physical discomfort, and it's something that we can be doing, so that it can still be uncomfortable, but it doesn't have to be complicated. And that's an important distinction. Also, that in when we think of you know, bringing attention to an object that brings well-being, a sense of uplift, so that attending to, yeah, to right view, to right understanding, these are ways of attending that helps the mind to be at ease, uplifts the mind. If we uplift the mind, the body will tend to be more at ease. So there's also sometimes with even within the experience of the body, to be able to direct attention to a place in the body that doesn't feel uncomfortable. Generally, of course, our attention is drawn and pulled towards the feelings of discomfort. But we can also direct our attention to a place in the body where it is neutral. It's like when one has a headache, generally the whole sort of field of awareness seems to sort of gravitate up to the head, and to shift attention to something that is neutral, just paying attention to the sensation of the hand, say like the hands, if one's sitting like this, this sensation of the hands touching the legs like that. It's a very neutral sensation, and exploring that kind of neutral sensation as a means of realizing that we've got options. When something is uncomfortable and painful, it always feels like there's no options other than to be miserable, and just to recognizing that we can direct attention in many different ways. How can we balance knowing and letting go with investigation? In what circumstances should one be used rather than the other? Well, I think one should always, I mean, just using the phrase knowing and letting go is maybe a bit misleading sometimes, in the sense that, and certainly Ajahn Chah himself is a great example of somebody who always encouraged us to be relying on investigation, relying on a contemplation of experience, and not letting circumstances go past without becoming fully aware of things, so that the knowing and letting go is also isn't just kind of slapping the label of knowing and letting go on it, and it takes a willingness to look at experience and know it from different angles, know it from different aspects, so that one starts to really see things clearly. Because it's only then that we're really able to relinquish a bit more fully, to let go a bit more fully. And even the letting go is sort of, well, what happens when I let go? What's the resistance to letting go? What's the result of letting go? What is the way that the mind turns in trying to let go? What ideas do I have about letting go? There's all sorts of ways that we can be investigating to be able to understand the process. So that investigation should be a part of all of one's practice. It's not even if one's doing a samatha practice, taking just really trying to become more one-pointed and peaceful. You can't really do that without investigating what works, what doesn't work. Investigating what's the result? How to become more skillful? How to become more more attentive and clear? So that investigation has to be functioning on many different levels. And that being said, it's also, I remember Ajahn Chah saying that they say the most efficacious investigation comes when the mind has really stopped thinking. So that the mind becomes still and clear, but one's developed that interest in investigating, so that one's looking at things with that light of trying to understand it, trying to penetrate it. And it's not, but it's not a restless proliferation. It's there's a clarity that we're able to apply to our experience. Okay, dear Lumpo, what were you like before you became a monk? Were you always so kind, generous, warm, and trustworthy? Hardly. yeah. Confused, miserable. indulgent, many things. It takes time to really change. Okay. Please explain how the Buddha believes in devas. Devas, ghosts, but not in a soul. Wouldn't these sort of spirits and souls fit into a similar realm? Well, the thing is that devas or ghosts, a soul is something that is if it's going to be something that's actually worth a soul, it should be fixed and stable. And that's the actual definition of a soul, in the sense of that's sort of the inner kind of being, but that is eternal, and that whether it's devas or ghosts or human beings or animals, I mean, it's all an impermanent process of these conditions arising and ceasing and constantly changing, and then moving between different realms, so that human beings get reborn as ghosts, they get reborn as devas, they go up and down, and devas drop into hell, they get reborn as humans. It's all this, which is what the word samsara as pertaining to the world of birth and death, the word samsara literally means is just the wandering on. I'd say that constant movement of being and becoming, and of course that happens in just in this say in this in being right now of that we experience as ourselves. There hasn't really been a time that is when we've been completely fixed and unchanging. It's just that's the nature of existence. So that's where the Buddha says, "Yeah, it's not. This is not self because it isn't fixed. It isn't stable." Lopa Jamnian has said that 80% of the yogis he's known who have entered the stream did so while listening to the Dhamma. He also said that most were lay women or nuns. What are your thoughts? I don't know. I don't have the powers to know that. So that. But certainly the, in terms of looking to the suttas, then the vast majority, even more than 80%. So when we read the suttas, the experience of entering the stream is while listening to Dhamma. So that is a strong conditioning factor for being able to that, because one of the other one of the other epithets or words that's used for one who's entered the stream is one who has attained to right view. Or there's another one that is one with, say, complete right view. So that arising of right view is a distinguishing characteristic of one who's entered the stream. So that oftentimes the trigger for that rearranging of view so that it aligns itself with Dhamma. And it certainly happened when listening to Dhamma. And in listening to Dhamma in particular, of course, was that yesterday when I was talking about the stock phrase in the suttas of the when the person who's listening to become calm, become sort of steady, become eager and trustful. There's this sense of there's a settling because of listening to the teacher. But it's also that person has to be allowing themselves to become settled and to listen with interest and listen with a mind that's ready to receive the Dhamma. So that is a conditioning factor. So, Yeah, and Ajahn Chah was somebody who never really talked very much about attainments, either his own or other people, so that he would most often just talk about the factors to be attending to or to be developing in order to prepare that ripeness of heart. When I asked a Thai friend what her gamatana was, gamatana, meditation object, she said, "Kwan Wang," then added, "Dam Wang." Can you explain? So, Kwan Wang is like emptiness, and the way, the idiom that it could be interpreted as sort of like complete emptiness, full emptiness. It's an unusual use of the language, which I haven't heard anybody use before. Kwan Wang is ordinary, in the sense of speaking about emptiness as an object of contemplation. And it's actually one of the means of establishing the mind in order to it's called an well it, the English translation is you. There's emancipation, so that there are different types of emancipation, so that through the contemplation of not self and the directing attention to emptiness, so that emptiness is a gate, or either a gate into understanding not self, or the manifestation of the result of contemplation of not self. So that it works both ways. Similar with contemplation of impermanence, of anicca. And these are also types of, say, of concentration or samadhi. So that the concentration or samadhi based on emptiness, it's on a nimitta samadhi. So this samadhi concentration based on impermanence, and it literally means sort of signless. So that one's not holding to any signs, any manifestations of phenomena. One's seeing the arising and ceasing as the object. So the mind settles in one point. With a signless concentration, and contemplation of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, it's both apanahita samadhi and apanahita vimoksa, so the emancipation through desirelessness, or the concentration through the gate of desirelessness. And desirelessness in the sense that one's seeing clearly the fraught nature of experience, so one isn't conceiving of a desire towards phenomena, and the mind settles and frees itself. The first time I was confronted with an English roundabout, I drove in the wrong way. I may still be going the wrong way, as I have murder in my heart. I want to eradicate an infestation of insects on my tree so that it can bear fruit. Any suggestions for an approach that will keep me on track, at least an attempt at the five precepts? I think that's sometimes when we're faced with that commitment to the precepts and commitment to a conduct that is virtuous, we sometimes don't get what we want. One starts making choices, and it's important to start to recognize what's really important. What's the desire behind? What are the options? And what are the different ways of dealing infestations of insects? I know in Thailand there's farmers that are really committed to using a Buddhist practice in all levels, and they've come up with some really interesting uses of different herbs and different essential oils that are both attract and repel insects and in their gardens and their fields, it's a really interesting application of both the precepts and that commitment to kind of really holistically looking how nature works. So that's a way we tend to have, especially that our culture tends to not have many options. If something gets in the way, you get rid of it. Exploring the options. But I think that holding it in mind as well, that sometimes one can relinquish, say, one's investment in a particular tree to protect one's precepts. The opposite is also true in the sense of like Ajahn Chah used to go around the monastery, and that was one of the things that was really important, was really looking after the ways that you protected the dwelling places. Especially when you're living in a tropical forest, termites, they just get everywhere. So you have to really be on top of keeping them at bay. And we'd have moats that have water, and you have oil that is so that the termites can't go across it, and you have to be on top of that. So that isn't a matter of just sort of say, well, we live in nature, so everybody's got to live. So there are certain things you want to be looking after, and we have to be making those choices. Okay, that is the questions for the evening. We can go and have a quick break and then come back for evening chanting.